country. We're going to support this government, this country forever. We're going to support our supreme leader. So you just have to stop interfering in our affairs. And we want to say that down with the U.S. because you've been the cruelest country in the world.
We celebrate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution to show the world that despite all riots and plots hatched by the enemies, our Islamic Revolution is strong and powerful. We love our leader and the Islamic Revolution and are ready to sacrifice our life for the ideals of our revolution.
Addressing crowds of people at Azad Square, Iran's president, Ibrahim Raisi, said West's policy of imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation.
West's policy imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. The United States and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The Iranians managed to make the enemy's plots futile. The West, the U.S. in particular, stands accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region.
The demonstrators underline the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country. Analysts believe that after 44 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic establishment, Iran has now been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom seekers and the oppressed nations of the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting 270 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects, to take part in the 13th Ahwaz Oil Show. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are on the list of U.S. sanctions.
We have invited all of the local companies operating in oil well services, instrumentation, and the production of any equipment that's required in the oil and gas industry. They are here to achieve synergy with each other and state-owned firms with the ultimate goal of increasing our oil production.
For decades, Iran relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery from drilling bits to pipelines.
After almost 110 years of dependence on the import of drilling bits, our engineers at Asmari, along with other Iranian firms, have been able to indigenize the bit technology. So we design and manufacture a range of drilling bits locally, and this is thanks to the restrictions caused by sanctions.
With regard to sour service pipes, our company used to import them for its oil-related projects. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel, but after Trump imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, we put our heads together and managed to produce our own anti-corrosion pipelines.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions against Iran in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs. That's why the government in Iran is now making a seismic shift to local manufacturers to rebuild its oil sector, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
About seven decades ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector, something which experts here describe as another turning point in the oil industry, as it would shield the country's economy from the impacts of oil embargoes. Yusuf Jalali, Ahvaz.
Okay. In line with a fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television executives, as well as TV and radio station managers, led by the Russian Deputy Minister of Digital Affairs, visited the IRIB World Service's TV and radio stations. That included the Spanish channel Hispan TV and the English news network Press TV, a chance for the Russian delegation to observe the technical developments up close.
Both the Russian and the Iranian side have reached a point where they are ready for practical steps after holding several rounds of meetings and signing cooperation agreements. We have laid the groundwork, and our audience will soon be enjoying our joint TV and radio productions.
The visit also provided the opportunity to discuss potential areas of cooperation.
We can cooperate in exchange of content. It's movies, TV series, it's cartoons and documentaries. There is a very broad field.
The details were carefully discussed in order to break down the steps and see how the two sides can take cooperation to the next level. First and foremost, representatives were appointed from both sides to be directly in touch and to be in charge of joint media productions from now on.
Iran and Russia are both under pressure and sanctions by Western countries, so this meeting and the one we had 2 days ago are of strategic importance. There is great potential, and I believe that we can immediately begin joint radio production.
But the highlight of this meeting was how to neutralize Western sanctions, particularly in the field of media, with the Iranian side sharing its valuable experiences in this regard.
We are witnessing a new world order, and under these circumstances, regional and international powers such as Russia, Iran, and China will be growing closer and develop stronger alliances. Russians are experiencing sanctions aimed at isolating them since the war in Ukraine has begun. We can share years of experience with them in this regard. Our media cooperation not only allows unheard voices to be heard, but it will also reshape public opinion.
Both sides agree that the groundwork has prepared and joint production can start in 2023, marking the beginning of a strategic alliance in a multipolar world where all voices can be heard. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
An accord sealed in early January between the Italian multi-utility company Iren and Israel's water carrier Mekorot has triggered protests in a number of Italian cities. As a multi-utility firm, Iren, which operates solely in Italy's northern regions, provides services related to gas, electricity and water. The company's four major shareholders are the municipalities of Genoa, Turin, Parma and Reggio Emilia. On Tuesday, a council meeting held in the northwestern city of Genoa ended up in chaos, with some opposition councillors staging a protest against the Iren-Mekorot deal.
Mekorot is accused of stealing water supplies from Palestinians in the occupied territories. Through the denial of access to water and sanitation, Mekorot collaborates with the far-right cabinet of Israel in the implementation of institutionalized water apartheid, which is a central component of Israel's policies of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities. We believe the deal should be scrapped.
Over the past years, companies in a number of countries, including Portugal, Argentina and the Netherlands, have pulled out of deals signed with Mekorot. The decision to sever ties with Israel's water company followed protests over Mekorot's role in Tel Aviv's water apartheid against Palestinians. Israel's Mekorot provides drinking water for Israeli settlers and infrastructure for water supplies in the illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Not only Israel is accused of manipulating water supplies, but it also prohibits the construction of water networks to provide drinking water in cities and villages. Humanitarian organizations accuse Israel of violating Palestinians' rights, included in several international agreements and conventions.
Israel is stealing all the water of Palestine. Mekuru has been signing deals with many international companies across the world, and now it's Italy's turn. We denounce Israel's criminal policy of water apartheid against Palestinians and will call on Italy to respect international accords.
It is estimated that while the Palestinian population of the West Bank has doubled since the Israeli occupation formally began in 1967, water allocation for Palestinians has remained at 1997 levels. It's not just the Genoa's councillors who are calling on the municipality to scrap the Iren-Mekorot deal. Councillors from the municipalities of Reggio Emilia, Turin and Parma have demanded the governments to do the same. Max Civili, Rome.
The fifth meeting of security representatives from several countries to address Afghanistan problems has been held in the Russian capital, Moscow. Participants have come up with a number of practical measures to take joint actions in the fight against terrorism. The measures include curbing terrorism finances, intensifying cooperation in the field of combating transnational organized crime, illegal arms and drug trafficking, and preventing illegal migration. The measures come at a time when the U.S. authorities are using the frozen Afghan assets as a tool to blackmail the country. In December, Russia's permanent representatives to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, called on Washington to immediately return the funds stolen from the Afghan people. He called the U.S. freezing of Afghanistan's assets outrageous. This, as Afghan authorities are still reaping the fruits of chaos left by the Americans, and the situation in the socio-economic sphere is rapidly degrading.
Washington, London and their allies continue to freeze Afghan assets illegally instead of allocating them for humanitarian works. Moreover, attempts are being made by Western countries to plunder the funds, including by setting aside part of them to pay compensation to relatives of September 11 attacks victims in which the Afghan people were not involved.
The Iranian representatives called the situation in Afghanistan a consequence of the U.S. policy.
Iran is a country hosting the largest number of refugees from Afghanistan. They are provided with a variety of opportunities, including higher education through state subsidies. Approximately 300 to 350,000 children from Afghanistan study in our schools, and about 6,000 Afghans study at Iranian universities. We do not have any camps for refugees. Afghans live on an equal footing with other Iranian citizens. We do not make any discriminatory distinction between Iranian and Afghan students. Moreover, given the difficult economic situation in Afghanistan, we grant scholarships to refugee families for the education of their children.
The secretaries of national security of the participant countries described the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan as pre-planned and prepared. Under the pretext of fighting the terrorist group that Washington itself created, the U.S. wants to force Afghanistan's neighboring countries to open their doors to American bases. That's a policy aimed at expanding the U.S. presence in the region. Such meetings are seen as an attempt to neutralize and contain the U.S. approach. The Moscow format on Afghanistan was created in 2017 that brought together Russia, Afghanistan, China, Pakistan, Iran and India. Later, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan and Uzbekistan joined as well. Participants have so far held several meetings aimed at helping Afghanistan, which has been devastated by years of the US-led war. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A conference near the UK Houses of Parliament to mark the 12th anniversary of the Bahraini people's uprising against the Al Khalifa regime. A reminder that the reverberations of what happened on Pearl Square in 2011 continue to be felt today.
There is a momentum for the revolution that the crisis has not ended. It is there. It is escalating by the day. It's not really diminishing at all. And it is our feeling that the people will not give up unless there is a good degree of concessions. And my feeling also, the regime cannot do that.
This is what it looked like when the Islamic awakening reached the Kingdom of Bahrain 12 years ago. The protesters' main demands, socioeconomic justice and democracy. What they got from the regime, though, a state of emergency, and a violent crackdown that lasted for months, aided and abetted by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many were killed or injured, many more jailed or exiled, making Bahrain a country with one of the worst human rights records. Yet none of that impacted its relations with the corridors of power here in the UK, which lists Bahrain as a core market for its arms sales.
The relationship that the UK government has is a special relationship because historically it has been an ally of successive repressive regimes for a single purpose, well, a dual purpose. One is obviously the issue with regard to oil, and the second is the strategic importance of Bahrain. And what we've seen is a pattern of governments, successive governments of all political persuasions, put those interests, both strategic and with regard to oil, economic, above the basic civil liberties and human rights of the people of Bahrain.
The kingdom is also host to American and British military bases. Neither country offered any support for the uprising at the time.
Bahrain has an embassy in London, and the UK is one of four European countries to maintain an embassy in Manama. The participants here say it's time the UK government rethought its cozy relationship with the regime in Manama, held it accountable, and stood up for the people of Bahrain. Said Burza, London.
In recent months, Alexei Reznikov has been mixing at the highest levels within NATO and the EU. He's just been sacked as Ukraine's defense minister amid a fresh corruption scandal. There was no mention of this at a press conference following a meeting of EU affairs ministers in Brussels on Monday. It was confirmed, however, that attempts are being made to apply more pressure on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
We continue to work on the 10th package of sanctions to be in place by 24th of February, 1 year after the invasion started.
EU taxpayers have already sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine. Ministers pledged on Monday to keep the money flowing. This as mortgage repayments in the eurozone are going up after the European Central Bank increased interest rates. Citizens have been talking to us about the cost of living crisis.
I bought my house, and so it's very, very hard to pay.
My weekly bill went from 50 euros per week to 100, 150, and I live alone. So
with 50 euros, you cannot buy some food for a week. You can just buy for 1 or 2 days.
It's several hundred, definitely. Several hundred euros per month.
More than you were paying.
Yeah.
The ECB is raising interest rates to try and control inflation, but it's damaging the EU's competitiveness. There's concern employment will be impacted.
Credit to the private sector is becoming more expensive. Bank lending to firms has decelerated sharply over recent months.
Analysts say EU sanctions against Russia are backfiring as higher energy costs spread throughout the bloc's entire economy. There is no relief in sight for mortgage holders in the eurozone. The ECB has indicated it will increase rates further in March. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrors fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The
The 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution has been marked across Iran and the world. Record numbers of people came out to mark this momentous occasion. This year's celebration was especially sweet, since it also marked the major defeat of foreign-backed riots against Iran. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Iran's achievements and how it has been able to advance despite the extreme sanctions and pressures imposed on the country, especially from the U.S. First, our guest for this edition of the program. Shubha Rizvi, political analyst, joins us from London. Also joining us, Zakir Ahmad Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst, who joins us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Shubha Rizvi, I'll start with you. Taking a look at the popularity as the theme of my question, we're looking at 1,400 Iranian cities and 38,000 villages of people that came out of marking this occasion, the 44th year anniversary. This is a record number of people showing up on the streets. What do you think about the turnout, which obviously is testament to the popularity of this revolution, even after 44 years, amongst all Iranians?
Indeed, congratulations to you and the Iranian nation on this tumultuous and fabulous occasion of the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The numbers that have come out that you have just sort of related to, that shows very clearly that a generation, I'm of a certain age, which has seen the revolution from day one, if you like, and have been observing and visiting Iran on a regular basis. And what one sees is that there is an undercurrent of support for the Islamic Revolution and the leadership without any doubt. Of course, there have been challenges, as everyone knows, the sanctions that you talked about, the maximum sanctions, the sanctions from day one, the imposed war, drowning of the civilian plane in the Gulf during the eight-year imposed war on Iran, all kinds of heinous crimes that have been committed against this particular nation over the last 44 years. And it is quite remarkable. Remarkable is perhaps a too soft a word. It really is extraordinary that a nation has withstood all kinds of pressures that has been exerted on its people. Over a million people died, as you know, during the eight-year war. After that, sanctions issues, being taken out of the economic sort of transactions globally, SWIFT system. Nonetheless, no political system can survive for such a long time without there being support from the general public. And this clearly shows that when people have turned up in the numbers that are indicated from small villages to big cities and so on, that clearly shows that the appetite for the revolution is has not really reduced in any way from the early days, if you like. And it shows that the second generation, if you like, of the revolution is still following in the footsteps of what Imam Khomeini laid down and what the Rebbe Ayatollah Khamenei is sort of continuing.
Zakir Ahmad, how important was it to see this type of a turnout, especially at this point in time?
The turnout is particularly important. I think that it is it's important at this juncture to again congratulate the Iranian people and yourselves and echo the voices of the Iranian people. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. God is great. This is significant in that it defeats the theory that is persistent within Western media that this is a revolution that is on shaky ground. To the contrary, the visuals that we are seeing, the support that we are finding in the streets, cements the fact that this was as a result of a referendum that was held. 99.5% of the Iranian population elected to have an Islamic constitution, an Islamic revolution, Islamic form of governance, and supported Walayat al-Faqih. So we cannot peddle this false narrative when the facts are so clear to all and one and all. This is a tremendous victory for the Iranian people. It's a date of congratulations to each and every one of them for overcoming the machinations of the United States and Israel. The proof is in the pudding, as they would say, and it's clear in front of us all today.
When you take a look at the fact that you had this Western hybrid war, as Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi pointed out in a speech at Shabir Rizvi today, it really looks at the way that the enemies altogether have failed. When it comes to how they actually went out all and they put it all in against the Iranian nation for the past few months, 3 or 4 months, from the media campaign with the Saudi-backed TV channel to the UK-funded state TV, the BBC Farsi, all really failed. Do you think that, what does that show in terms of why they failed and why Iran was successful in that regards?
Well, I think one of the things that the Western media quite often forgets that this revolution wasn't just, as Imam Khomeini said, for watermelons. It was a revolution, an ideology to implement Islamic rules and regulations in a particular nation so that other nations in West Asia and far afield can also apply the model. So what has really happened is that reliance on God and the slogan Allahu Akbar is used in Iran as a positive sign, unlike other sort of elements of the Daesh and other sort of terrorist groups who give the name, the word Allahu Akbar a bad name. But it's in Iran, the word Allahu Akbar is used as a motivational factor so that people can rally around the revolution. So the hybrid war, the media war, the social media war, all kinds of tactics which are used in this narrative have really not only failed, but have shown to be quite hollow in many ways. And they really haven't made much impact. Yes, of course, it has created somewhat of a difficult situation in the last few months in Iran, where people have got confused. And of course, you've got the 4 million Iranian diaspora outside Iran, and many of them are not really supporters of the Islamic Revolution. And they have also, of course, voiced their opinion against the Islamic Republic, because those are the people who really did not want anything Islamic in the nation. What you've got to remember is that prior to the Islamic Revolution, Tehran and Iran, particularly Tehran, was seen as the bastion of Western lifestyle. Alcohol was available, nightclubs were available, all kinds of Western sort of socializing was easily available. And those are the things that, you know, the diaspora living outside wants to bring back into Iran. But I think the majority of the people in Iran do not want to have the same kind of social interchange in Iran.
Right.
And that's why they've stood firmly that they want to give a model to the world which is working, is successful, and at the same time is sort of, you know, standing firm and resisting to all kinds of activities that are being used by the West to bring down the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Zakir Ahmed, it's this misunderstanding of the West, in particular the U.S., that has caused lots of problems. Of course, Iran has been used to that. I mean, for decades at this point, we can talk about how they've imposed maximum pressure on Iran, of which even U.S. politicians have come out and they have admitted that, yes, for example, the U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, Robert Malley, has said that the maximum pressure campaign mounted by, he says, the former U.S. President Donald Trump has failed. Why is it that the U.S. in particular has misunderstood Iran to such a degree that I can guarantee you if at least for the past 44 years it had focused on diplomacy and finding out how it can iron out differences, they would have been much more successful than trying to fight the Islamic Republic all this time?
I think it comes down to the very nature of the Islamic Revolution. We know that the Islamic Revolution, ideologically, it was built on four particular pillars: the inseparability of the religion and politics and the state, Islamic revival, the concepts of the cultural revolution, and as the primary aspect was the creation of a committed Muslim. What that means in modern terms, it's a person with values, it's a person with family values, it is a person that understands the principles of justice. We know that in terms of the Islamic Revolution, the concepts of mustadafin versus mustakbirin, the arrogant, these are very key and fundamental concepts which stand directly opposed to Western imperialist values, those that are espoused by the United States. United States is built on exploitation, not just only of foreign nations, but of their own population. We look at the turmoil and discontent within the United States in itself, the police brutality, racial violence that has taken place throughout the United States. And we look at the Islamic Republic of Iran that is standing strong on values, on basic concepts of family, on basic concepts of assisting the Muslim world, that we are one nation. We must not forget that it was the Islamic Republic of Iran that was one of the first nations to respond to Syria after this horrific earthquake, despite the sanctions and all the other pressures that have been placed on Syria. They did not care about that. They answered the humanitarian call. So when you look at what the Islamic Republic really is, it is a complete counter to the self-interest of the Western world, upon which the United States and many other Western nations are built, and they have to try every trick in the book to try and fracture the Islamic Republic. In fact, this is not an old thing with the maximum sanctions campaign and sanctions. There was an article by the Rand Corporation dated 2012 where they said, is regime change the only option on only solution for Iran? And they admit that the United States can no longer effect the changes in Iran as it did in 1953 when they toppled the elected government of Mohammad Mossadegh. So you have an acknowledgement that they are slowly losing their abilities to change the Islamic Republic. Mm-hmm. There is talk in the Israeli regime as well that you need to accept the fact that Iran is now a nuclear threshold state. It is well established within the region, and even the concepts of a military option are no longer available. It's okay, simply because of the very strong and deep rootedness of the Islamic Revolution, and this will always be contrary to the United States and Western.
Well, the advancements that were made after the Islamic Revolution and prior, when you make a comparative study there, Shabir Rizvi, is quite astounding. Taking a look at steel production, for example, back in 1977, 1,300,000 metric tons, but the year 2018, as an example, 24,520,000 metric tons. I can't even, is that even right? It's just so much more. Electricity, ranked 16th in the world and provides Iranians with the lowest priced electricity in the world and the civilian nuclear program, like our guests there talked about. Of course, overall, we're looking at advancements in so many different ways, but much of it as a result of these sanctions that were imposed. So isn't that one of the major achievements, thanks to the U.S. and other countries that sanctioned Iran, that was able to advance in so many different fields, some of which I just mentioned now?
Well, look, the rebel, Ayatollah Khamenei, has quite correctly pointed out that the sanctions have been actually a gift from God to the Iranian nation. If there were no sanctions, perhaps the Iranian public may not have advanced in so many areas as you have just enumerated. So the sanctions have given a possibility to be reliant on domestic science, domestic industry, domestic sort of academic work. And one of the things that you perhaps are going to mention or forgot to mention is really the issue of women. It is quite
often. I was going to mention that. I was going to mention it, but I figured I'd leave it for the last. Leave the best for last, as they say. But you go ahead. You go ahead.
You were talking about, you were so many sort of great things. But I think the key great thing that has happened compared to what was 43 years ago is the role of women and the education of women. 60% of undergraduates and graduates in Iran are women. Nowhere on this planet is there a country where the majority of the graduates coming out of university are women. So the issue of women marginalization is a non-starter. It's completely a baloney. It's a completely sort of imagination on part of certain Western sort of writers. And even they admit that women, and you look at next door, what's happening in Afghanistan with the issue of women, it's very clear that in Iran, women have actually done a lot better than they did prior to the revolution. That's right. Just one sort of aspect of it. And if you look at, you know, other issues, child mortality, longevity of people living, all those factors have really improved post-revolution.
Right. I'd like to expand a little bit more on the women literacy rate in particular there, Zakir Ahmad, because Shabir Rizvi for the graduation of women in terms of the percentage that you mentioned, 60 or 80, I forget what you said. But taking a look at another stat, back in 1976, 37% of the women were educated. And fast forward to the years 2015, 16, 17, up to 87% are actually educated. And I'm sorry, I have to mention this also. When it comes to the number of doctors, back in 1979, you had 1,988 doctors. Fast forward to the year just 2012, and this is I couldn't find anything beyond that. But just that year, which is going back a number of years, you have 20,177 doctors. You can see there, Zakir Ahmad, the advancement that women have made. So give us your impression on that. But overall, the fact that education, not just for women, was one of the pillars of how Islamic Republic has advanced, of which Iran's leader has said that the West in particular is targeting the education of Iran and the ones who have advanced that way, is what they are focused on. If you can also add that to it.
I'm going to start with the aspect of education and try and work back to the statistics that you've just mentioned. One of the key aspects of the Islamic Revolution, as I mentioned, was the Cultural Revolution. And it was very clear that the Pahlavi regime had structured the education system in such a way to exalt the qualities of the monarchy and to impose Western values within the education system. Therefore, it was a key principle of the Islamic Revolution to purge this from the education system, because that was the factories upon which the human mind is molded. And therefore, it was very important to bring Islam into each and every aspect of the education system. Therefore, any attack now on the education system is very important, because it's trying to break the backbone of the Islamic Revolution. And the key product of the Islamic Revolution is to ensure that you have a good human being, a good Muslim. Now, going to the issue of women and women's education, I'm going to just touch on two points. One is that Iran is ranked first in the world when it comes to the ratio of men to women in education. You have 1.2 females for every male. This is something that's not spoken about or conveniently forgotten within the Western narrative. It is now fixated on the concept of the headscarf when they are turning a blind eye to France and Sweden and Switzerland and numerous other countries where they expose women and call that freedom against their own will. You really have to question their double standards. When I can, and the second part that I'm going to refer to is my own personal experience. I had the fortunate experience of traveling to Tehran in 2012. And the one thing that I can speak about, we know that violence against women is prevalent throughout the world, and particularly the country I'm from, in South Africa, unfortunately. And one thing that I've noted, and I recounted this to a fellow colleague in the legal fraternity just very recently, I said that when I walked in the streets of Tehran, I had noticed that every male had lowered his gaze. It did not make a female feel uncomfortable. Females had the ability to walk freely and openly without any fear of harassment or degradation. And that is the quality of the Islamic Revolution. You have liberated the female population. You have brought them into society. You've included them into society. You've not objectified them. You've empowered them. And these are the mothers of the nation. These are the individuals that shape the future generation, okay. And the Islamic Republic has restored their dignity. There's nothing in the Western narrative that can undermine that. The proof is in front of you. You can see it in their education. You can see it in the firm revolution that they put up, and you see it every day in the streets, and also the legacy of the martyrs, which they have all raised.
Indeed. My last question goes to you, Shabi Rizvi. When it comes to the issue of defense, Iran has rapidly advanced in that arena, particularly in the military defense. From you can talk about drones. You can we can talk about also how they just revealed some fighter jets, of which again all produced within the country. When you take a look at other countries that the U.S. basically has allied itself with, some of them don't even produce a light bulb, like Saudi Arabia. How important is the fact that you have a country like Iran resist and win over the U.S. and its pursuit offensively in the military arena when it stands on its feet, producing its own military equipment and then asserting itself that way? Less than a minute, please.
Well, look, as I said earlier, sanctions have been a miracle for Iran. And similarly, the defense industry has been able to progress in the manner that it has is because the sanctions were applied so aggressively. If they were not, then Iran would have been importing all kinds of armaments from neighboring countries or from Russia or from China or from wherever it was possible. But because of the sanctions, they had to develop their own industry. And due to that, it has become certainly a number one military power in West Asia, without any doubt. And for that particular reason, all this sort of nuclear issue just a bogus. It really is that they want to emasculate Iran by not allowing it to produce its own armament industry.
Thank you very much, Shabir Rizvi, political analyst from London. And thank you, Zakir Ahmed Mayet, attorney, activist, and political analyst from Johannesburg. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Ikaba Tawe and the team, it's goodbye.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
British Petroleum, known as BP, has cut its climate pledges while reporting record-shattering profits. According to reports, BP is planning more fossil fuel output than expected, after reporting a record $28 billion in profits for 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted in this regard, BP, a London-based oil giant that has attempted to style itself as a leader of the renewable energy transition, announced recently that it is slashing its emission reduction goals and planning more fossil fuel output than previously expected, after reporting a record $28 billion in profits for 2022, more than double what it made the year before. Compared to its earlier plan to curtail fossil fuel production by 40% below 2019 levels, the company said it now intends to cut output by just 25% by 2030. BP correspondingly now aims for a fall of 20% to 30% in emissions from the carbon in its oil and gas production in 2030, compared to a 2019 baseline lower than the previous aim of 35 to 40%, the company said in a press release. The oil giant also said it plans to pour just as much money, up to $8 billion, into its fossil fuel businesses as its so-called transition growth engines, which include renewables by 2030. BP's announcement came a day after the head of the United Nations said fossil fuel companies that can't establish credible plans to sharply reduce carbon emissions should not be in business. "We need a renewable revolution, not a self-destructive fossil fuel resurgence," said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. BP's decision to scale down its climate goals drew the ire of campaigners and scientists who stressed that growing fossil fuel production is imperiling global hopes of having and staving off even more catastrophic warming. "Just when we need to be rolling back oil and gas production, BP is rolling back its climate commitments," said Doug Parr, Greenpeace UK's chief scientist, adding, "Don't let the spin disguise it. This looks like BP edging back to being a traditional oil company." Climate scientist Bill Maguire argued BP's announcement further demonstrates that fossil fuel companies can't be trusted to voluntarily cut production and potentially sacrifice short-term profits for the sake of the climate, no matter how splashly their pledges and rebrands. BP cuts its emissions pledge and plans a greater production of oil and gas over the next 7 years compared with previous targets, Maguire tweeted, adding, "This is criminal. Fossil fuel cores must be forced to stop drilling. It is our only chance now." BP is the latest oil and gas behemoth to report record-shattering profits for 2022, a banner year for fossil fuel companies, thanks in large part to the ongoing energy market impacts of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. In its fourth quarter earnings announcement, BP said it would boost its dividend and buy back an additional $2.75 billion worth of its own shares. The company repurchased $11.25 billion of its stock last year. Importantly, we are delivering for our shareholders with buybacks and a growing dividend, BP CEO Bernard Looney said in a statement, adding, "This is exactly what we said we would do and will continue to do, performing while transforming." Freya Atchison, oil and gas campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, called BP's profits sickening and said fossil fuel giants are being allowed to bank billions in profits whilst millions of ordinary people struggle to pay their bills. Atchison added bosses and shareholders at these big polluters are being allowed to get even richer by profiteering from one of our most basic needs. The harm caused by the fossil fuel energy system couldn't be clearer, saying these companies are not serious about climate action or transitioning away from oil and gas. The evidence shows they are spending just a tiny fraction of their profits into truly green projects.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.